You're listening to an American Free Press podcast. On March 16, 2003, Rachel Corrie, a 23-year-old American, was brutally crushed to death by an Israeli army bulldozer while trying to protect a home from demolition. While Israel, in typical fashion, claimed it was an honest mistake, just like their vicious attack of the USS Liberty 36 years earlier, Ms. Corrie's violent death came to symbolize the Jewish state's blatant disregard for anything and anyone not sympathetic to their illegal and brutal occupation and treatment of Palestinians whose land they are stealing. I had the great pleasure to speak with Rachel's parents, Craig and Cindy Corrie, who have taken the heartache of losing their child to reach out with nonviolent means to those interested in continuing Rachel's work. On the telephone with me from Olympia, Washington today are Craig and Cindy Corrie. Thanks for joining us today, Craig and Cindy.
Thank you for having us.
A lot of activity in your lives lately.
There's a great deal of activity in our lives right now, and there really has been. We struggle to find space, quiet space, really, because there has been so much to attend to, and so many people have reached out to us from around the world for different reasons since our daughter Rachel was killed. But this is a particularly demanding time.
Right. Well, thank you for taking the time out to be with us today. I know it's very difficult, especially around now. Can we start from, I guess, what we could call the beginning, when Rachel went to Palestine? What inspired Rachel to go there?
Rachel was a college student. She was nearly 24 years old when she was killed, when she had completed all of her college work before she went to Gaza. But when 9/11 happened here in the United States, she was in school at the Evergreen State College.
Right.
It was a huge event in her life. I sometimes say to people, I think for me, although they're not similar, really, the Kennedy assassination was huge. I was a teenager at the time that happened, and it was the first sort of national trauma that I had experienced. And I think 9/11, of course, so many people killed, and such a troubling event, had the same impact on Rachel and on her generation. And she went looking for answers. She went looking for reasons for why this had happened. And she was involved with a college program called Local Knowledge. Evergreen is a school where learning from a lot of different areas is integrated. Two or three faculty people will work together to provide a program and will look at subject matter from different perspectives, all as part of one program. So Rachel was in this program called Local Knowledge. It had never been taught before. They were going to look at the kind of buried history that exists in all of our communities and to see how that history was relevant to what was happening in the present.
Right.
And when 9/11 happened, that sort of changed the course of the whole class, and there was a strong community connection to it all. In our community, the peace movement really awakened at that time. There was a lot of concern as we moved towards war as a response to what had happened. And Rachel became very connected to different parts of the peace movement here. She was part of a group called Olympia Movement for Justice and Peace, also the Fellowship of Reconciliation,
right,
and other groups. And as we moved toward war with Iraq, she became very, very involved. But she was looking for answers to why all of this had happened on September 11th, and that took her to the Middle East, to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. She studied that she had friends who in 2002, in the summer, went to the West Bank and one to Gaza with something called the International Solidarity Movement, which was a organization, a movement that had formed after there was a resolution in the United Nations to bring a human rights peace monitoring force mm-hmm. to the area after the start of the Second Intifada, and which was in 2000. That resolution was vetoed in the United States, and as a result of that, this organization, ISM, was founded. It has Israeli co-founders, Palestinian co-founders, and American co-founders. And Rachel's friends, some of them went to one of the earliest parts of this effort, which was called Freedom Summer in 2002. They came back, they wrote about what they were doing and seeing. There are two reasons, two qualifications, I guess, to be involved with this. You have to believe in freedom for the Palestinian people based on international law, and you have to agree to use only nonviolent methods of resistance.
Right.
And so Rachel was really engaged with what her friends were doing. She was studying this issue, and she started to think of herself about going. She studied Arabic in college. She was very good at it. Her instructor, who is from Nazareth in Israel, told us, you know, she was his best student. He encouraged her actually to wait to go because he said she was at a point where she was so close, her grasp of it was so good that if she studied a little bit more here, he thought she'd be just ready to become fluent, you know, in Arabic
right.
once she was there. But she felt a strong desire to be there because of the impending Iraq war. There was a lot of feeling that things would get much worse in Israel and Palestine if we went to war with Iraq. Now, it didn't materialize quite the way I think people envisioned. It wasn't as though more Israeli tanks or anything rolled into Gaza particularly. But over the course of years, certainly our distraction with Iraq really did make things much worse for Palestinians as well. Things really did deteriorated there. Right. So I think she was correct in that assessment. But that's what took her to the West Bank, took her to Israel first, then to the West Bank for training with the International Solidarity Movement. And she chose very specifically to go to Gaza and to Rafah in Gaza because she felt like that was where the greatest need was for internationals to come and be in solidarity with Palestinians.
Right. And of course, most people know what happened. She was protecting a family's home from demolition from a D9 bulldozer, some huge Caterpillar armored tank. Is that right?
Yeah. She, the Nasrallah family were actually two brothers that lived in an upstairs-downstairs duplex, and Rachel knew that family. She went to visit the family, as we have visited them numerous times, but the first time was about 6 months after Rachel was killed, back in the fall of 2003 when we were there. And they lived in a home that was close to the border with Egypt, not the border with Israel, but the border with Egypt.
Right.
And when they bought it, the land, and built on it, it was just part of a neighborhood. There were houses actually going through the border because part of Rafah actually is in Egypt. So they were part of a neighborhood, but then the Israelis were building a corridor along there, and they were smashing down the houses that were along that border. And so by the time we got there and by the time Rachel was there, this house was just out of the end of a road and no homes between it and the border. She knew the children that were there when she stayed there. There were five children and, of course, two adults in both families, so four adults all total in these two families that lived there. And Rachel would help the kids with their English homework, and they would try to help her with her Arabic. Cindy
right.
laughed because when we first went there, the children were trying to get Cindy to, they didn't even try with me, but they're trying to get Cindy to speak some Arabic, and they'd laugh at her and say, you know, Rachel could say all these words.
Right.
So she knew the children. She wrote about sleeping on the floor in the back bedroom with these the parents' bedroom with the older brother's children and his family, because the children's bedroom was on the side of the house that faced the border. And Israeli tanks would come along with this now through the rubble that had been knocked down from other homes, and sometimes they would shoot into the houses. And so this children's bedrooms had bullet holes that would go through inside the bedroom, through the wall between the bedroom and the living room, but a third concrete wall would stop the bullets. And so in the evening, they'd take the children out and into the back bedroom where the parents were. And as Rachel wrote about it, they'd all sleep there in a big puddle of blankets. Mm-hmm. So Rachel very definitely knew this family. And she got a call. She was actually trying to protect some water workers that were trying to repair a well in Rafa, and got a call that some tanks were close to that home with bulldozers, or a bulldozer and two tanks. Excuse me, I'm saying that backwards. Two bulldozers and one tank or armored personnel carrier were close to the home, and they wanted some more International Solidarity Movement people down there so that they could make sure that they try to position themselves between the bulldozers and the home and make sure that nothing happened to the home. So she went down and joined her friends down there. And for several hours, these bulldozers would push. Sometimes it was just cross the sand and sort of leveling the land, but also they were pushing on walls that went around somebody's orchard or garden there. They were pushing on some a home that had, a building that had been destroyed, and another one that somebody was trying to build. So they were attacking some structures, and that went on for several hours. Close to 5 o'clock, both bulldozers and the tank retreated towards the border. And what we know now is that they actually were trying to get new orders, because the internationals would not disperse, and they were interfering with from the military side. They were interfering with the work, so they were trying to get orders to just go someplace else. And they got some sort of order. We haven't heard the exact language of it, that said, don't let these internationals stop you from your work. Go back in. And 5 minutes later, Rachel was killed. So the bulldozer went on a run straight towards this that Nasrallah's home. Rachel stood in front of it, and knowing that these children and the family were at home, they were in the wall, behind the wall that she stood in front of. And this time, the bulldozer didn't stop. It proceeded over her. The eyewitnesses, her friends, say that as it pushed the dirt, generally it would come right up to one of the activists and then it would stop. Right. On one occasion, it rolled well, I think, into some concertina wire, and another, Alice got pushed up against a wall. But when their friends would shout, the bulldozer would stop. This time, it just kept coming. And so at the last minute, Rachel realized it wasn't stopping, apparently. She climbed up on top of the earth that it was pushing, and then her leg got caught. The bulldozer then just proceeded until essentially his cab was over where she had been standing. And then the international eyewitnesses say that without lifting its blade, it backed up over her again. She was actually alive for a second, a little bit after, when her friends reached her. She said, "I think my back is broken." But that's the last words that that she said. And she was pronounced dead at the hospital by the time they got her to the hospital.
And when did you get word of this?
This was March 16th, 2003. We were in Charlotte, North Carolina, where Craig and I were living at the time. It was about noon there, and the phone rang. Craig, I had been in Washington, D.C. that week. Actually, I went to the first large march I had ever attended. It was the last march, a women's march on the White House before the Iraq War was going to start.
Right.
And I just felt I needed to go to that because of where Rachel was and of how strongly she felt about the possibility of the war in Iraq, and we felt similarly, so we'd been working on it. I was trying to sort of collect myself in the apartment, pick up things that organize papers and so forth, because I'd done some organizing there. And Craig was doing the laundry across the way, and the phone rang. It was my son-in-law, who lives here in Olympia, which is really our long-term home here in Olympia, Washington. And right. Kelly said he wanted to speak to Craig. And I sensed immediately that there was something wrong. Something in his voice told me there was a problem. And I told him Craig wasn't in the apartment, but he was just a short distance away. And I asked him why. And then he just said, "We've had very sad news." And I could hear my daughter, Rachel's sister, Sarah, crying hysterically in the background. She got on the phone at that point. And she said, "It's Rachel." And I asked immediately, I said, "Is she dead?" And I think when I look back on it, I just think I needed to rule out the very worst possibility. I wanted to get that out of the way. But of course, what I heard back from Sarah was that they had been at home. It was 9 o'clock in the morning here on the West Coast. They were having their breakfast. The phone rang. They didn't answer it, but the message machine kicked in. And a neighbor, a friend, said, "I've just heard about the tragedy, and I'm so sorry. I heard about it on television." They went to their television sets and turned it on. And scrolling across the bottom of the screen was the words, the message, "Olympia woman killed in the Gaza Strip." That's the point at which they called us, because Sarah thought, if this is Rachel, why haven't Mom and Dad told me? And then she realized that we must not know. They called us, and while she was talking to me on the phone, and as I was carrying the phone to Craig across the parking lot, right. Kelly went back to the TV and came back, and he said, "It now says Rachel Corey, Olympia, Washington, killed in the Gaza Strip." So that's how the news came to us.
Right. Now, of course, you have organized and you run a foundation in her name, the Rachel Corey Foundation for Peace and Justice. How soon after this horrible tragedy did you put this foundation together?
Actually, pretty quickly, although it's an ongoing process. So, you know, we sort of filed the papers, I think, within a few months. You meet some just really wonderful and remarkable people out of this tragedy. And so one of those people was Linda Beale, came to speak at the University of Washington, I think like two and a half weeks after Rachel was killed. And you may remember her daughter, Amy Beale, was just out of college and went to South Africa to try to sign up the Black South Africans to vote in the first ever national voting that they had down there, and she was dragged from a car and killed by some of the people that she was trying to sign up. They mistook her, I think, for an Afrikaner or whatever.
Right.
But so Linda then had worked, really set up a foundation. She actually, you know, once we got to know her, heard some of her story, she actually testified in the Truth and Reconciliation hearings in favor of two of the four people that killed her daughter. And those two worked for her foundation. And Cindy's seen them on TV, Linda and one of the people that killed her daughter, you know, talking about that and having this process that they went through, you know, in South Africa. So we very soon met, Linda was one of the remarkable people that we met, and she had started the foundation. And so we started thinking about that. And just, you know, when something like this happens, particularly with the international incident that Rachel's killing was a part of, they're just, I remember thinking when I met her, you know, you're on a path that has very few footprints on it, but she, right. She was one of the footprints. And so we're very lucky to meet her. And, and while we haven't really kept in touch, she's been a role model. And so that's when people started sending money, you know, and just, I think, to help us out. And we had immense support from people around the world. But, so, you know, somebody send $10 or $20 and, you can't just really go out and have a beer with that.
Right.
You gotta do something.
Right.
And so it became, you know, it became something that we could start and think about, maybe at first think about how to continue what Rachel was started, but also it's now been 7 years, and you can't do somebody else's work for 7 years. You got to integrate it in and make it part of your own work. And I think as we've begun to know the people that were Rachel's friends, and they've now become good friends, you know, it becomes our work. It's a voice we have, and so we need to use it.
So it was really in many ways inspired by ordinary folks just sending in money and you using that money to create this foundation. So it wasn't something that you really had in your mind. Is that what you're saying?
No, I think that's really true. I think another thing that happens when you have something like this happen in your lives, I know many people say to me they just can't imagine it. And they are very moved by how we've moved ahead, by the steps that we've taken.
Right.
But I can say from this experience that it isn't like you sit down at some point and develop your long-term plan for the future. You know, you just take the next step. That's what we did the day that we got the word about what had happened with Rachel. We contacted our son in D.C. We made the decision to go there because we knew we needed help from our government, from and our son who lived there. Craig that day, when he got to D.C., he thought he had thrown shirts into the suitcase, but he had thrown pillowcases into the suitcase. You know, you don't, and in a way, you know, that's kind of how things continue. I mean, we're a little, of course, we're more settled now. We're able to think better than we were on that really worst day of our lives.
Of course.
But we still, I mean, you still, and I hope that's encouraging to people. You know, it isn't like you always can plan forever, but you take the next step, and that's what we did with the foundation. So it is very much, as Craig said, a process. And I can't tell you the kind of encouragement it is for us still that there are so many people around the country that care about what we're doing and want to encourage us in some way. Sometimes that's with the activities and the things that they're doing themselves that they let us know are happening, or it is that they put $5 or $25 in an envelope and send it just to support our scholarship program or our delegations going to Gaza or the Olympia Ruffa Solidarity Mural Project, one of the many things that we do here. All of that is just tremendous encouragement, and I know we benefit from it. It keeps us going. And I hope that it works in the other direction as well.
Right. And on the website, which is rachelcoreyfoundation.org, you have a mission statement and also a series of principles. And you, of course, support human rights and justice for all. But you say you will emphasize efforts to alleviate the burden on women and children who too often suffer the most. Did you specifically get that from Rachel, or is that something that...
All of those principles were considered and written and developed in the early years of the foundation. We were working with community members here. We had multiple meetings with members of our community, with some of Rachel's friends, and with students at the Evergreen State College, where she attended, and we talked about what was important for us to keep in mind as we continued to do this work. And definitely that one had to do with where Rachel focused. It had to do with the fact that she was a young woman in the world also, creating her path, but it also had to do with her connections to women and children in Gaza, where her life ended, but where her spirit still very much lives. When we went to Gaza in 2003, we went to the General Union of Palestinian Women to meet with a woman named Fatima, the director of the this place in Rafah.
Right.
And she pulled out a note that Rachel had written to her. It was on International Women's Day that year. And Fatima was so proud to have this note to show us. And she wanted a head-sized portrait of Rachel to put on her wall. She had a photo of Arafat there. I mean, people know that Arafat's very significant to Palestinians as someone who worked to try to pursue freedom for all of them. And it's not common for people to put photographs necessarily on the wall, but she wanted to have one of Rachel there. We met that day with her five or six other women from Rafah who wanted to share their stories and to talk to us about what their needs were. But Rachel had gone there on International Women's Day. The note was written because they hadn't been able to connect, but it was just so important to her to be... in tune with the women. She wanted to create connections with people here in Olympia and women in Rafah. Mm-hmm. She worked in the Children's Parliament, which was at the time a place where children would go and learn about and talk about democratic principles and then learn to make speeches and so forth about issues in their own lives. There's a video of Rachel actually testifying about George Bush and about the war with Iraq and about what they were actually talking about Ariel Sharon, what was happening towards Palestinians from the Israeli military at the time and also about Iraq. And what I think is interesting is these children went through this trial and Rachel worked with them and helped too, but their solution was that, you know, that Bush and Ariel Sharon should be taken to the world court for investigation. It wasn't as though, you know, that seems to me like a pretty nonviolent response to your homes being destroyed,
and, yeah,
which was happening on a mass scale in Gaza, and your family members being imprisoned. There are, right now, there are nearly 8,000 Palestinian political prisoners. Almost every family that you talk to in the West Bank or Gaza knows someone who's been in prison for sometimes their teenage years, the years of their lives. So many, and now the numbers are huge in Gaza because of Operation Cast Lead, which were the attacks on Gaza at the end of 2008 and early 2009. There were over 1,400 killed. Wow. When we went there last year, and people would be so happy to see us, and we'd have conversations, and they were so excited. But I always felt compelled to ask them how they were impacted by what happened in Operation Cast Lead. And almost invariably, they would say, my cousin died, my mother died, somebody died. So when I think about the work Rachel was doing and about the large numbers, I mean, we hear about the violence against Israelis, which has happened through the years and which is very painful and objectionable to us. But I think we failed to really take in the amount of violence that has been perpetrated against the Palestinian people and how ongoing that is in so many different ways.
Right.
So I just think it's quite remarkable that those children, having a mock trial about Ariel Sharon and George Bush, chose having them go to the world court as a response.
Not a bad idea.
Not a bad idea.
Now, Rachel Khoury is, of course, now a household name, not just in Rafah or Gaza or Palestine or Israel, but around the world. There was a play, wasn't there, called My Name is Rachel Khoury, is that right?
Yes. Actually, right after Rachel was killed, I mean, in the hours after Rachel was killed, maybe let me backtrack a little
okay.
bit. We always tell long stories. But
that's fine.
Rachel brought us to this issue, and so even before she went to Rafah, she was mostly working with her mother, who had some time and probably the more sympathetic ear, but talking about where she was going. And then when Rachel got to the West Bank and then went on to Gaza and Rafah, she wrote emails, a lot of emails back to Cindy, and those brought us to the issue. They educated us about what was going on, and we would send those out to our extended family and others so that they would also hear about it. So when Rachel was killed, actually, I think my cousin talked to Cindy, and Cindy said, we've got to get her words out. I think just maybe a day later, or maybe a few hours later, we heard that the Guardian newspaper in London wanted to do a article on Rachel, and so they were looking for some quotes, and could we send some of her writing their way? So we sent all these emails, you know, we kind of packaged them up and sent them off to the Guardian, and a day later we got a letter back from their editor saying this is kind of the most powerful human writing about the Gaza Strip that we've seen in a long time. Mm-hmm. We've decided to just put the email in a section, and which they did. You can go out online to the Guardian on, I think, on March 19th, 2003. They had a section they called Rachel's War and just ran the email. And so that was in London, it was in the newspaper, and a friend of Alan Rickman's read this, and she handed it to Alan and said, you need to look at this. He read it and took it to the Royal Court Theater. They contacted our family and said they would like to work on this for maybe a workshop or something. And so it took us some time to get back with them. We had some friends or family members try to do a little research on the Royal Court Theater. Of course, this is a tremendously well-known, internationally respected theater for new writers, I think, that they've worked on particularly.
Right.
But we had no clue. And so we actually met with people at the Royal Court in, let's see, it was October 2003 on our way back from Gaza. We stopped in London and met with people there, including Alan Rickman, and had a brief interview with him, maybe an hour, hour and a half. And I also said at that time, you know, Rachel wrote all of her life. Would you be interested in some more writing? And they said they would. We didn't get it to him for about another year. We actually were back in London, and I'll backtrack again. There were three people killed on that border, the same border with between Gaza and Egypt, within about 7 weeks of each other, and the killings were about 2 miles apart, and there were three internationals. Of course, there are many Palestinians that are killed during that time, but three internationals. So Rachel was the first. She was crushed by an Israeli bulldozer. And then Tom Herndl from London was shot in the head and died of his wounds in January of 2004. And then James Miller was a photographer, a cameraman, and out of England, but was shooting a picture for HBO at the time. And he was shot and killed by the Israelis as well. We, by this time, knew the Herndl family by telephone and by email, and so we were stopping in London to meet the Herndl family. And at that time, Tom was in a coma, but he was still alive, so we actually met Tom. And then Tom died, like I said, in January 2004. We came back. That family was starting their foundation, and we came back to speak at kind of a kickoff dinner that they were having in London, and Alan Rickman happened to be there, and I was sort of trying to hide from him because I hadn't got him the stuff I promised.
Right.
But our daughter Sarah was with us, and I asked him, are you still interested? And he said, yes, but no pressure. You know, I understand it might be hard to do. And Sarah said, I'll do it. I'll get it to you. And Sarah was good to her promise. A few months later, she had gone through all of Rachel's journals that she could find and typed up the writing that she found there and sent it off to Alan, who then worked on it at the Royal Court Theater, and along with another writer, Catherine Viner, who is an editor for The Guardian, but also on the board at the Royal Court Theater, and they put together this play, which is all from Rachel's writing, or a couple of emails from Cindy and me and one of Rachel's friends. It's a one-woman play, and it opened in a small space at the Royal Court Theater in the fall of 2005, and then went to a larger place. Well, maybe that was the spring of 2005, and then went to a larger place in the fall,
right.
And then the West End of London in the spring of 2006, and finally got to New York City off Broadway in the fall of 2006, and has now been I like to say on every continent of the world except Antarctica. I don't know that it's been played in Antarctica.
Wow.
But, yeah, it's in, I'm not sure how many languages, but at least a dozen.
Wow.
So it's been a pretty powerful voice for Rachel, you know.
Absolutely, for the whole peace movement, the global peace movement.
Yeah, it's amazingly engaging way to get to capture somebody's thoughts and bring them along, because it really does follow Rachel through some early years, and you know, you start to know a young woman, and then go with her to this really strange, exotic part of the world for Rachel and for us, and see wonderful people there, you know, and you see what she sees, but you also see the violence, and it's and her outrage at the violence.
Right.
And I, you know, young people will see this. We live these stories, and well, I think a relative of Alan Rickman's said they lost track of him. He was gone for 5 hours. Well, he decided to walk home instead of take the subway, and just think about the play.
Mm-hmm.
And so hopefully it gets people to think about what they can do, if not in Gaza or Palestine. Then, you know, you've got a lot of choices, unfortunately, in this world. South America, your own soup kitchen. A woman who was an actress and did, I think, 2 runs of the play so far in Australia. In between the runs, she took several months off and volunteered in Africa. And she told us she did that because of Rachel.
Wow.
You know, so it's pretty amazing sort of stories we hear out of that.
Absolutely. Now, you said it was off Broadway. It wasn't on Broadway. Is that right?
It was intended to come to the New York Theater Workshop in the spring of 2006. And there was controversy that erupted. It was very concerning, very upsetting to people at the Royal Court Theater who were bringing their production to New York, and, of course, to our family as well. What we learned and what was published in the New York Times was that the artistic director of the New York Theater Workshop had talked to some of his Jewish friends who said it wasn't a good time. Ariel Sharon, Israeli Prime Minister, was in a coma in the hospital at the time, but there were just various excuses for why it shouldn't come. And that prompted a very strong reaction in New York, which was both amazing and heartening, I think, to us. There was an event on the day that the play was to have opened at Riverside Church in Upper Manhattan.
Mm-hmm.
That's a church where Martin Luther King spoke about the Vietnam War.
Right.
Craig and I went to this event because we saw it was developing into something very important, so we made the trip to New York to be there. The facility was full of people who came to hear Rachel's words performed by actors and activists and people from throughout New York City, people from the theater movement, people with theater interest, activists,
right.
And Jewish friends of ours who were, and people that we didn't know, but Jewish members of the New York community who said, this is what happened with the New York Theater Workshop is not our view. We will not stand for this kind of censorship. And so there was this enormous event, and then eventually that fall, then the play did come to New York, but it was through the Hammerstein Productions. Dina Hammerstein, she's connected to the Hammerstein family, is a friend of Alan Rickman's. She very much wanted to bring the play to New York. That's part of the work that she does, is to, with her production company there. And so the play did come to New York City, and I'm proud to say that it's been in cities throughout the United States as well.
Right, but there was controversy about it.
Yes, yes. And I think... I don't mind the controversy. I think we all know that there's a lot of division in this country around this issue, and that there are people working very strongly to make sure that we maintain the status quo in this country,
right,
in our relationship with Israel, particularly with our funding Part of the reason that Craig and I have become so engaged with this is that the more we learned about it, the more we thought about it, the more we felt our own tax dollars purchased the Caterpillar D9R bulldozer
right. That
killed our daughter.
Right.
Israel receives more military aid than any other country in the world from us. And it's just, the number's just growing. So I think we in this country need to engage with this whole thing. There are certainly people that want it to continue and the relationship to continue as it has.
Right.
And that breeds some controversy and discussion. I think that discussion is actually a very good thing. And so I hope that if the play has the potential in any place to open that discussion up, and also I think to humanize the people who are most directly involved with it. I think from a distance we have a very distorted view of who the Palestinians are. Sometimes we have a very distorted view of who the Israelis are, mm-hmm. and Israeli Jewish people as well as Arab Israelis. So I think whatever we can do to create a larger discussion, a more transparent discussion about all of this is healthier for everybody.
Absolutely. Now, there's a trial going on, isn't there? Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, yes. Of course, when Rachel was killed, one of the most important things for us was just trying to get at the truth of how she was killed and what happened. And that proved to be pretty difficult to do. The day after Rachel was killed, Prime Minister Sharon promised President Bush a thorough, credible, and transparent investigation into Rachel's killing with a report to be given to our government.
Right.
And it's now been 7 years. It's been throughout that time, really, the continuous position of the U.S. government that what investigation there's been done into Rachel's killing has not met the standard of being thorough, credible, and transparent. That was put into writing, that position was put into writing by Colin Powell's chief of staff when Powell was the Secretary of State. Mm-hmm. And it's been repeated again by several people out of the State Department. So it continues to be the case. When we first met in person with people at the State Department, the highest-ranking person in that meeting was Colin Powell's chief of staff, Larry Wilkerson, and we talked about, at that time, we were waiting to see what sort of investigation would happen, what sort of report would happen.
Right.
And so we had a discussion about that, and then Mr. Wilkerson turned to me and he said, if it were my daughter, I wouldn't care about money, I wouldn't care about anything, I'd sue him, I'd take him to court. And that was kind of the first time that we'd taken that sort of thought seriously. That isn't the way we wanted to pursue this.
Right.
But as the statute of limitations ran out, which is just 2 years long, that may sound like a long time to somebody to decide whether they want to enter a lawsuit, but it seems short when you're living it.
Sure.
And we ended up filing a lawsuit because we could just see that, you know, the messages we were getting from the State Department is that there had not been a thorough, credible, and transparent investigation into Rachel's killing, nor could they do anything to force one by the Israelis. And we were also hearing from our Justice Department that they would not be able to do an investigation themselves. So we did file that lawsuit. That would have been in March of 2005. And it finally, we finally got our first day in court in March of this year. And so we've been in Haifa throughout March with this trial, and then it's been on sort of a hold, and will resume in September.
5 years it took.
Yeah.
5 years after the suit was filed. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, seven years after she was killed.
And I'd just like to clarify that when Mr. Wilkerson made that comment about taking it to the Israeli courts, that was in response to a question about what would the U.S. government do if the investigation that the Israelis produced wasn't adequate. And the first part of that discussion was that people in that room were sure that it would go to the next level, which we presumed would be the White House. They didn't clarify, but we were already, talking to Colin Powell's chief of staff. So we assumed it would go to the White House. But then the follow-up response from Mr. Wilkerson was, though, that if there wasn't adequate investigation, if this didn't happen, then what he would do would be to sue. So, and there has been support, for that point of view from the U.S. government. So it isn't like we just decided one day to file a lawsuit. It's something that we've talked to a lot of people about and that there's been support. Actually, in the trial this spring, the first part of it in March, there were two representatives from the American Embassy present each day. The Consul General of the United States was there on at least one day. We met with the ambassador. We also met with some of Vice President Biden's staff when they were in Israel at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's very problematic that the U.S. government, when people at the highest levels of our government have pursued information from Israel, and what we're told is that their questions go ignored or unanswered, I think that's very problematic. And I think there's still an issue between the U.S. government and the Israeli government over Rachel's case. I think it's problematic that a family in our position is really forced almost into having to work through the courts in order to have any accountability when you have a citizen of the United States killed by a foreign military that we are funding. But these are very large and challenging questions. We've been addressing them as best we can for 7 years, and I suspect we'll be doing so for some time longer.
What's the suit asking for?
We charge in the suit that Rachel was unlawfully killed, that her right to life, her right to dignity were violated by the Israeli military, and alternatively, that the Israeli Israeli government was grossly negligent in what happened that day. I don't know if you're asking if what we're asking for, of course, is a judgment
right.
About that. In the Israeli courts, it's different than here in the United States. It's been quite an education, and in fact, the trial itself has become, in a sense, a project of the foundation, because there's a lot of education that can happen about the process of seeking accountability and truth and justice
mm-hmm.
in the world by following something like this. But the testimony is provided through affidavits from the witnesses, but then there is also in-person testimony in the court. A judge hears all of that and makes the determination about what will happen. We are in Haifa court, Haifa district court, but their district court is not equivalent to what we talk about as district courts here in the United States. It's actually a higher level court than what our district courts would be.
Okay.
But there is no jury. So we've had the first part of the trial. The second part will be the state's witnesses coming forward. And then once it's all completed, once the affidavits are all there, and once all the court testimony is taken, the judge will take all that material and will look at it, I guess, with consideration for Israeli law, and then make a judgment.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of damages, I have to say that I'm not completely clear about that. Craig can maybe speak to it even more better than I can. There are different kinds of damages in Israel. Again, it's different than what it is here in the United States.
Right.
What I do know is that we enter, if there should be a ruling in our favor, then there would be another portion of the court proceedings, which would be to measure the loss and to evaluate that loss. And then I assume from that there would be some determination about how that would be addressed.
Yeah, there are three kinds of sort of monetary damages. So you've got the actual expenses, sort of thing. And actually, that from U.S. point of view, that we asked for a very small sum there. Then you'd have the sort of pain and suffering kind of damages, and that's not specified. And then we also had asked for punitive damages.
Right.
And actually, through a part of the the stories go on and on and on. So part of the trial actually ended up with the person that did the autopsy on Rachel, and unfortunately, we did give permission to do an autopsy. We didn't want an autopsy done, but we were told that probably we would not get Rachel's body back unless there were an autopsy done. And so we had given permission to do an autopsy, provided it was done by somebody who was not a military doctor and was done in the presence of somebody from the U.S. Embassy.
Mm-hmm.
And it took us years to find out, but we found out that, in fact, there was nobody from the embassy there when the autopsy was done. And then in court this March, we found out that he had taken some sort of I don't know whether it's just tissue samples or actually larger than that, but at any rate, when we got Rachel's body back, we still haven't gotten all of that, and we didn't realize that until March. So there was questioning about this doctor, Professor Hiss from the Abu Kabir Institute that does the autopsies in Israel, and the judge was stopping the questioning because he said there's essentially no loss riding on this. The trial is about Rachel's killing, not about her autopsy. And our attorney said, well, but it goes to the damage of the evidence.
Right.
And the judge says, but there's no money associated with that. And he said, well, we're asking for punitive damages. And the judge said, how much? He said, well, we haven't determined that yet. And the judge said, you have 5 minutes to tell me how much.
So
we had to make a decision. Well, it turns out in Israel, if you're going to ask for punitive damages, you have to put up, I think it's 2% of the damages in a bond when you ask for it. So how do you measure the value of your daughter? No amount of money is enough. Do you say $5 million and then wire them $100,000 the next day? And you basically not likely, unless you win, you're not going to get that $100,000 back. So you had that sort of pressure, and then we've always said it wasn't for the money. We wanted to go through a process where we could depose witnesses and go through discovery and try to find out what was going on there. So what we wanted was to have this professor on the witness stand and stay there while we asked questions about what he was doing with our daughter's body. And so we ask, in this case, for the punitive damages, we set it at $1. And the judge said that he would waive the 2 cents that we would have to
nice
give him. And our attorney, the court is proceedings are all in Hebrew. So we're getting somewhat of a translation of what he was saying, but explaining that again, we were trying to go through this process to find some sort of information. We're going through the process to hold Israel accountable, and we wanted to get at the truth, and it wasn't about money.
Right.
And you'd see the judge sort of smiling and nodding his head. So he allowed the proceedings to go forward on that basis. But it is true that our motivation, again, is to just try to do for ourselves what our government's not been able to do, which is get an investigation and hold the people responsible to some sort of accountability.
I just wanted to add, I'm not sure if Craig mentioned that the autopsy has become an issue for a couple of reasons, but one major one is that there was an Israeli court order that said the autopsy could occur, but only with somebody from the U.S. A U.S. consular presence at the autopsy. And the doctor who did it simply violated that. He just couldn't be troubled to make sure that somebody was present. We didn't know that for years. We didn't know about the court order for some time. And then we, in their report about of investigation of Rachel's case, there was a military police investigation done, which is Many cases do not get investigated at all. So Rachel is one step ahead of a lot of people who have been harmed by the Israeli military. But in that, it's said that somebody was present at the autopsy. It's in their report. It's in the conclusions to the report that they released to the public. And that was a lie. That was a falsehood. And so it's just another piece that points to the inadequacy of the investigation that occurred.
Right. Do you suspect a cover-up of some kind?
There hasn't been an investigation. So I think in that sense that probably you could certainly characterize that in some sense as a cover-up. There's certainly been some parts of it that are incredibly questionable. At trial, we did have called the witnesses. He's really more of a witness for the state because he was a member of the Israeli Defense Force. He was part of the military police investigating team that investigated Rachel's killing. And he testified, again, under oath, that while he was getting a statement from a person inside the bulldozer, there were two people inside of each bulldozer. One was the operator and another, you call a commander or a navigator, so somebody could see outside and say, go left or right. And I think he was taking the testimony from this navigator. When the navigator's commanding officer, a colonel, came into the room and told the navigator to stop giving his testimony and not to comply with the investigation. Now, I believe that eventually the officer was able to continue to, some days later or something, to continue asking questions. But, you know, here's this, what looks to me like an obstruction of justice that comes out of it. There's several other areas. You can see where the Israeli government just flat lied to our government about what happened to Rachel in the discussion that came out. Actually, it started in the first weeks or days after Rachel was killed, but they continue to use some of this line still. They have put together a PowerPoint presentation about 34 slides or something, and most of which were just general, talking about the Gaza Strip and their view of how dangerous a place it is. And of course, I guess my view is, if it's all that dangerous for you, don't go there.
Yeah.
Leave them alone.
Right.
But it's their yard, not yours. But at any rate, they have that, and then they have a picture. It's very grainy, very difficult to see, and it shows this bulldozer, and in front of the bulldozer is the mound of earth, and they have an arrow and saying, this is where Rachel's body was. And so what they're trying to say is, see, she couldn't be seen because there's this big mound of earth between her and the bulldozer. Mm-hmm. And that photograph was taken out of some video. The Israeli military had a camera on the border some distance away, and it at times was scanning exactly where all this was going on. And so some of that video has been released both to our government and our family and also to Israeli TV in various places. So, you know, we've had some of this available. Again, it's incredibly difficult to see. You can't tell who's walking where. You can tell as you watch the video that there's a big, you can tell the difference between an armored personnel carrier and a bulldozer and stuff. But it's hard to follow.
Right.
But our daughter, Sarah, did follow it. She broke it down on her computer to one-second intervals, and she looked at clean photographs that we got from Rachel's friends in color, so you could see, you know, Rachel's in red, and you could see other people, and, you know, they have a dark top and a light pants or vice versa. So she could identify everybody that's going there. For one thing, the bulldozer that ran over Rachel, there's kind of a iconic picture out on the web about that, taken by Rachel's friends, where Rachel is lying after she's been run over. She's lying in the earth, and the tracks of the bulldozer in the sand go on one on one side or one on the other. She's being held by her friends, and the bulldozer is sitting in those tracks behind Rachel. So it's in this this shot that you can find out on the web.
Right.
And there's a big clump of earth on the blade of that bulldozer. It's clear. You can identify that bulldozer because of this earth that's on it. Well, when you look at this picture that Israeli government was showing members of our Congress, our State Department, our embassy, that's not the bulldozer that killed Rachel. If you analyze the video, you can figure out that's not where Rachel's body was. And the bulldozers turned a different way than it was operating at the time that Rachel was killed. We have now seen I think probably they made a mistake. They released a little bit, a different section of film. So it starts a little bit later and goes a little bit longer than what we've had up until, until March of this year. So we've gotten slightly different film. I haven't looked that up, but our daughter Sarah has. She says it goes longer and it shows the ambulance crew coming to pick up Rachel. And they walk right past this spot where the picture is taken and go to where we had always figured Rachel's body must be. And so, that was always available and seen by the Israeli military that's putting together this PowerPoint. They obviously knowingly lied to our government about where Rachel's body was and, the situation when she was killed. So, cover up, I don't know, trying to spin, but it's just wrong, Absolutely. It's just wrong.
Absolutely. Now, you said the next part of the trial is going to be about 3 months from now, is that right?
As far as we know, we've actually just gotten word today about dates that extend from September into October. When we left in March, there were only 2 half days in September that were scheduled, and there are to be, I guess, as many as, 13 to 15 more witnesses. So it seemed unlikely that it could get completed in that time, but it looks like it's going to be during September and October.
And is this some kind of a summer recess that they're taking?
I understand that the Israeli courts have a summer recess, and this is part of it. The judge was taking a sabbatical after we departed, so I believe he had a sabbatical from April and then sometime longer.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not a quick process by any
means. No, not at all. They usually are. Do you have confidence that it's going to be fair?
Well, I think we should demand that it be fair, but I have a lot of confidence in our attorney and our legal crew, the people that are helping him. And by the way, it's all volunteers. So even when Cindy says, it's kind of a project at the foundation, what she means that the foundation is, for instance, not contributing money to the trial. What we are doing is trying to put information about the trial out on our website, so the webmaster, is probably. It's the educational part of that, getting the word out to the public that
right.
The foundation is involved in. But I've watched our attorney, as I was saying, talk, kind of cross-examination people under oath, and I have every bit of faith that he's going to be able to get more information out of these people. And so what I'm looking forward to is getting more of the truth out, more of the facts out, and there's not anything I can do, about whether the judge then pays attention to that or how he ends up ruling. He's capable of giving an honest ruling, and I certainly hope and demand that he does.
Right. What happened to the house that Rachel was protecting?
We visited that house in September of 2003. Craig mentioned before that at that time it was really the only structure left in what had once been a neighborhood. The family, after Rachel was killed, stayed there. We found out later, and it was kind of an emotionally hard thing. Once Rachel was killed, they just felt like they had to stay, that they couldn't leave. And what happened on that border, there were massive home demolitions. Human Rights Watch reported that over 1,600 homes were destroyed between September 2000 and September 2004
Wow.
to clear this wide corridor for the Israeli military. And homes would be threatened. Craig described the shooting into the homes that would happen when IDF vehicles would drive by the houses at night, particularly this happened. Rachel's actually first call to us was from this house, and I remember hearing the trembling in her voice when she asked me, can you hear that? Can you hear that? And it was shelling that she could hear happening on the border, and we could hear it. And our friend Khaled, who lived on the second floor of the house, he came to the United States with his wife Saman with their baby Sama in 2005, and they traveled with us. We do a lot of speaking, and they traveled and spoke with us and got to tell their own story. And Khaled would talk about how they would go out. he would take something called like spackle and go out and try to cover the holes in the walls, because they hoped that maybe if it didn't look like the house had been used for target practice by the Israeli military, that maybe soldiers in the tanks that came by later wouldn't think to use it that way.
Right.
So it was, the house was under terrible threat, and the family, after Rachel's killing, just felt like they needed to stay there and resist its being taken over. But most families under that much threat, with the firing and so forth that went on, would leave their houses. They always knew they had to have one person inside the house at all times. If they didn't, the Israeli military would come in and destroy those houses, saying that they were abandoned. But in September of 2003, it was still standing. It was not destroyed on the day that Rachel was killed. We went and had a wonderful lunch, our first lunch in Gaza with the Nasrallah family. And I'll always remember, Craig was called by some of the Palestinians who were there and were with us to come and look out the door and look through the hole in the garden wall. There was a crack in their garden wall that they watched up through the day Rachel was killed. But this day, when we were there in September, they wanted Craig to see that there was an APC vehicle that had pulled up nearly right outside their back door. And two bulldozers, or a bulldozer, a single bulldozer, was moving towards the house from the border area. And this was the one thing that we had coordinated this trip with the U.S. government. We had coordinated this visit, actually, with the Israeli military. It's the only thing that we coordinated with them. But they wanted us to report where we would be. And we just said the first place we were going was to this house. So we had talked to the people in charge. They knew where we were going. They knew we'd be going in a private taxi and so forth. But here was this bulldozer coming right towards this house. Craig was just outraged. He picked up the phone and called our contacts, both U.S. and in the Israeli military, and got a call back within a few minutes, wondering where the bulldozer was now at this point, and it had moved aside out of the way. But that's the kind of threat that even on the day that we went there to meet the family and to see the place where Rachel was killed, the family, the house, and I guess because we were in it, all of us came under some threat.
Right.
In later that year, in October, after we had left, the house was made completely unlivable. The Israeli military came in with equipment, cut the electric lines and other lines to the house, dug all around it, made it completely unstable. So the family was forced to leave. Dr. Samir's family actually moved, I believe it was 7 times before they were able to get into a place where they could permanently stay. Khalid Nasrallah's family, I think, moved 4 times before they got into a permanent place. Dr. Samir's family was actually subject to another home demolition, because housing, of course, with this much destruction, became really hard to find, and they thought that they were in a place that was far enough from the border that they wouldn't be threatened again. But in fact, in 2004, early in 2004, the place where they were living was also part of a massive demolition that occurred. So they went through 2 times of this happening. The house was completely destroyed in early 2004. We've seen photos. We've been back to that area, and it's gone through all sorts of transformations. But we saw photos, I guess, a year or two after the house was completely destroyed, when the family went out on March 16th to have a bit of a memorial kind of moment for Rachel.
Right.
They're holding a picture of her. They're standing in the photo, and the only way they could find where their house had been, because it was like there was kind of grass over the area at that point, was that they found a remnant of tile from their kitchen, and that's the only way they could pinpoint exactly where the house had been.
So it stood for about a year after Rachel's death.
It was less than a year. I think it was less than a year. I think it was maybe February. It's probably right at about a year. Right. But was unlivable by 6 months after.
Is the media telling us everything we need to know about these housing demolitions?
No. In fact, one of the things that was most troubling to me following media, and of course we look at it differently after having something like this happen than we ever did before. I tended to believe the things I saw in the newspaper.
Sure.
But when people start to write about situations that you know very personally and then about you and about your family members, then you start to see that nobody gets it quite right. But some people do much better at it than
sure.
others. But one of the things that happened with house demolitions is that there would be a statement in AP articles, Associated Press articles, that would say house demolitions are a 10-year policy of the Israeli government to destroy the homes of people who have committed violence against Rachel. And the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions and other organizations, human rights organizations in Israel, and I reemphasize these are Israeli organizations, have educated us and pointed out that punitive demolitions, the kind where houses were taken down because somebody who lived in that house had allegedly done something against Israeli citizens or Israeli soldiers,
right,
or had been part of a suicide bombing effort or something like that, those houses are what are called punitive demolitions. It was roughly about 10% of the demolitions that were happening at the time. Now, the Israeli Supreme Court, I believe it was, made those illegal some years back. I have heard that there have been some fairly recent punitive demolitions, but mostly those stopped, which is a very good thing. They were always very questionable. I think if people in the United States think about someone like Timothy McVeigh, who involved with the Oklahoma City, or responsible for the bombings there, nobody in this country would think it would be just to go in and take down the house of Timothy McVeigh's parents or sisters or brothers or uncles and aunts. And in these houses that were coming down for punitive demolitions, there could be up to 40 family members that lived in them because they're multiple stories sometimes and they have different parts of the family living in them. So they were illegal and fortunately mostly have stopped, I believe. But the other kinds of demolitions that continue are administrative demolitions. This is largely in the West Bank and particularly around Jerusalem,
right,
where Palestinians can't get permission, even though they've owned the land or have owned a structure, a house, for years and years and years, they can't get permission to build or to remodel or to do anything. And then, in fact, they will get demolition orders, and there are many around Jerusalem particularly where there's an effort to keep the population of Palestinians down, to diminish that population. Actually, there are many home demolitions there, and they're very controversial, and we know Israeli human rights activists who work very hard to challenge what's happening there. In Gaza and in other places, the largest percentage of the demolitions are clearing demolitions, and this is what was happening in Rafah, where the military will come in and take down large swaths of homes in order to make room for buffer areas or for a wall or for whatever else they're putting in at the time.
Right. So you've got the punitive, the administrative, and the clearing.
That's right. And there are wonderful resources about this. I would recommend that people go to B'Tselem, which is an Israeli human rights organization that focuses on the occupied territories on the West Bank and Gaza. And they have articles at their website about all the different kinds of ways in which Palestinian human rights are being violated. And again, this is an Israeli human rights organization that's challenging what's happening. And there's a lot of information there about home demolitions. ICAD, Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions, also has great resources.
Okay.
I'd just like to sort of point out one thing, and we've kind of mentioned some things around it, but as Cindy said, the part of the family that was in the house that Rachel was defending that was subsequently destroyed came to the United States and actually did a tour with us. And, of course, to get to the United States, you have to have a visa. To get the visa, you have to go, at that time, you had to go to Tel Aviv. And after their home was destroyed, members of this family were given a pass by the Israeli defense forces to go to Tel Aviv and to apply for a visa to come to the United States. They were given the visa to come to the United States. And believe me, a 34-year-old Palestinian male does not get a visa to come to the United States without being checked out.
Right.
You know, so what's remarkable to me is the Israelis destroyed their home and felt perfectly fine about this family walking the streets of Tel Aviv without anybody around them. And U.S. felt perfectly good about the people walking in Chicago or L.A. or Seattle.
Right.
There was nothing against the family here.
Right. It's pretty revealing.
They destroyed their home. Yeah, yeah.
Right. All of this stuff is, I mean, for, like Rachel said several times in her emails, for somebody living a middle-class life in the United States, it's very tough to digest all of this stuff. You guys have thrown yourself into it head first, and got to give you a lot of credit for what you're doing. And of course, what happened over the last couple of weeks with the flotilla, you were directly involved in that, or almost directly involved in that, weren't you?
Yes. We know people who were on board some of the vessels that were traveling with the Gaza Freedom Flotilla. And then, of course, the boat, the MV Rachel Corrie, that sailed originally from Ireland and was taken into Ashdod port, an Israeli port, by the Israeli military, Israeli
right.
Navy, didn't make it to Gaza, but certainly we were following their journey very closely. We know some of the people, the Irish activists, wonderful Irish activists who were involved with that effort and were involved with naming the boat for Rachel. Some of them we've spent some time with in Gaza. And that was, of course, very moving to us. What happened with the flotilla, the terrible loss of life, the really unnecessary loss of life was,
right.
of course, extremely disturbing. We continue to be, to try to bring attention to what's happened, to try with everybody to understand exactly the details of what happened, and some of it's confusing. But what we do know is that the Israeli commandos attacked in the dark of night, attacked the boat in international waters, and that the blockade of Gaza by the Israeli government, Israeli military, is an illegal blockade. It's intended, there are some blockades that are legal, as I understand it. I'm sure a lot of these questions will be debated. But this is a blockade to keep not only weapons out, as the Israeli government and sometimes the U.S. government like to say, but they're keeping out food and the seed is keeping out spices and
right.
Food and,
right.
and things in order to try to punish and to make very uncomfortable the Palestinians who live there in order to try to affect some political change.
Right.
And that is illegal under international law.
Right.
So I believe what happened in the waters of the Mediterranean will also be found to be illegal. It was certainly ill-advised. I would think there are many Israelis who believe that it was very ill-advised. Our experience, of course, with investigation figures pretty prominently for us right now, as there is discussion about how investigation of what happened should take place. Clearly, there needs to be one, and it needs to be done in as timely a way as possible. We understand, and it's kind of a moving target. I don't know where it all stands right at the moment, but that the Israeli government is not open to having investigation by others. They want to conduct the investigation as well. They should conduct their own investigation. Our question is whether that should be the only investigation that happens. We would encourage an international investigation with cooperation from the Israeli government.
Right, some kind of independent investigation.
Exactly.
Right.
And we're concerned because we've heard that the U.S. is supporting the Israelis doing their own investigation, possibly with some international observers. I've heard it would be the U.S. and maybe somebody from the EU. I think that's somewhat problematic too, given our history, knowing that the U.S. government has not been able to to produce or to insist that the Israelis produce a credible investigation in the killing of Rachel and in actually other Americans who have been injured by the IDF as well. So we would just urge an independent investigation that is impartial, trustworthy, and complete.
Now, the MV Rachel Corrie, I guess MV stands for motor vessel, I would imagine.
Thank you for telling us that.
Sure, no problem. MV Rachel Corrie, that was launched in, I guess, last month. Now, the name Rachel Corrie, were you consulted about that, or did you hear about it afterwards?
Well, I think we heard about it between when they made the decision to rechristen the ship, the MV Rachel Corrie, and when it actually happened. But so not really consulted, but we were certainly very pleased when we heard about it. And, you know, you look at that, it's not a little boat. It's a small cargo ship. I think it's 1,600 ton.
1,200.
Yeah, okay, thank you. and so it's fairly large, and they were hauling cement as one of the things they were hauling. They were hauling medical equipment and paper and school supplies. Cindy and I have been to the Gaza Strip twice last year, four times in total, but twice last year after the attacks of December 2004. 7, 8, and January 2009. Thank you, Cindy. And we can attest to, you know, just the wholesale destruction of houses and schools, municipal buildings, police stations, just about the whole infrastructure there. And so concrete made from cement is desperately needed. We've been in hospitals and other medical buildings where they talk about their machine slowly breaking down, so they don't, and they can't get replacement parts. So, you know, dialysis and other things can't happen there. And then each time we make a trip in there, we've dragged behind us a suitcase full of paper and crayons and stuff for kids, which is, you know, does nothing really to the 1.5 million people that are trapped there without these supplies, but it makes, I guess, us feel better and a couple of kids feel better. But the thought of a ship coming in with really large supplies of these articles, I felt really good about it. You know, it had a special part of place in my heart. So I would both expect and demand that all of those goods, in fact, get into Gaza. You know, they've been hijacked and taken to Israel. Israel says, well, they'll take the goods over the border. Of course, they've had several years to allow these sorts of goods to get into Gaza and haven't done it so far. That's why people, you know, individuals out there trying to break the blockade. But I, again, hope that these materials get through. Also, just the tactic of you know, individuals trying to get ships together, boats together, and run the blockade and bring this out to the attention of the world. I think that's been pretty successful, really. It's changed some of the discourse in the United States and certainly around the world. It's, of course, more than distressing. I mean, that the human loss of life associated with that. My hearts go out to those families that lost people on those boats, and you know, it.
It's horrible.
I don't know. They're in a situation that we have some understanding of, and it's terribly difficult. And I hope that those people who were killed, you know, that some good comes out of that. I think we all have to work to make sure that it does. That's our part, trying to make something positive come out of what's happened.
Well, you have the great fortune of having a congressman who I spoke with a couple of months ago, Congressman Brian Baird, and he has the great fortune of having you in his district. He told me some stories about Gaza where parents of terminally ill children are not allowed to go to the hospitals that they're in. It's just horrible what this country is doing to 1.5 million in Gaza?
That's right. Yeah. It's a very small place. You know, it's about 30 miles long and somewhere between 5 and 12 miles wide in different parts of it. And yeah, it's I know that oftentimes when children have to go to hospital, and some do get through to go to hospital in Israel, they're accompanied by a grandmother, but not by parents. And they're just very sad stories. We tried to bring artists. It's not a health situation, but we tried to bring some artists from Gaza here to Olympia because of Rachel's artistic side and interest, and because of what we think can be accomplished through creative arts. We have this mural in Olympia. We have images that have been contributed by Gazan artists and so forth. Wanted to bring them here to visit, and these artists went to Erez checkpoint. It's the only checkpoint through Israel that people can travel through. So they were going there to get to the American consulate to get their visa applications going, but they were never allowed through. And when we met with these artists last fall, they said they wanted still to come to the United States. They wanted to try again, but they did not want to go through Erez checkpoint because it was too horrible an experience for them, what they went through that day while they were determining whether they could get to Israel or not. They would like to go through Egypt. So it's a very difficult place, and there's a lot of pain. I think that's one of the messages that we bring too, is we do hear things in the news when there's a lot of violence, when people are killed, not always when they're killed, but we hear about the big things. But the kinds of humiliation and suffering that happens on a day-to-day basis as a result of this siege, and in the West Bank as a result of the occupation, it's that kind of day-to-day humiliation and just keeping people down that doesn't get articulated very well here.
Right. It can't be too good for their self-esteem.
Right.
Yeah, I think it is. It's also amazing, though, to me how particularly the adults, when you're in Gaza, how they work with the children trying to, for instance, be giving them classes in human rights. Like Cindy was talking about Rachel working with their youth parliament, those sorts of things. So you'll see really rampant unemployment there, but instead of just sitting at home, people will be out working and very much with the children, trying to make some, I see them just pushing back the rubble and all of this, holding back the F-16s and trying to make some space for these kids to grow up with some sort of positive feeling about themselves, each other. And they're amazingly capable of distinguishing between a U.S. citizen and the U.S. government. Or we've been there with not just Jews, but Israeli Jews, and they can make the distinction between the person in front of them and that, and the actions of their government. And that, to me, is kind of remarkable that people are still willing to do that when they're under the sort of pressure that Cindy described.
Yeah, I can't imagine. And reading one of Rachel's emails where she says that from what she's seen, the genocide, she said she's questioning her fundamental belief in the goodness of human nature. From what you've seen, are you too starting to question your fundamental beliefs in the goodness of human nature?
I think, you know, we see both of that. And I think it is frustrating. And, you know, you see, and I think about, you know, always making a distinction between actions of a government or an organization and just individual people. Because, of course, we have great friends in Israel and role models in Israel working on the same side that we're working on this. You see some of that. The easy word to use is evil. But I don't think any of us really concentrate so much on that. We're frustrated with it because so much more remarkable is just the immense humanity of the people that are working against that and the goodness that comes out of it. You know, Cindy described the home, the Nisrallah home, where it's being shot full of holes, and talking about Khaled putting spackle thing on that. Right. He also went to a psychiatrist or a psychologist and talked about strategies for holding the family together under all this stress. And at that person's suggestion, they went out and bought some rabbits. They bought 3 rabbits so that the children and the family members would have something to love and to care for. It is soft, cuddly, pet, and by the time the home was destroyed, they had 30 rabbits. They weren't for eating. but they are, somebody shoots into your house, and your response to that is to take care of rabbits.
Right.
Just the immensity of that, I don't know, positive reaction is a huge, Kyle is a huge role model to me. And one of the gentlest men that I've ever met. And so that's kind of where I think we prefer to concentrate because you got to. Just take another step. You kind of got to.
Right. You're not ready to throw in the towel yet on human nature.
I think no, we're not. And part of it's because we are embraced by so many people and supported and held up by so many people. And and we energize each other and do have faith that the work that we're all doing will make a difference. I think sometimes there's frustration, a lot of frustration. It seems to me when I look at the governments at what happens, and there's something very cynical about how things are carried out and articulated. I have come to a place where I don't believe that all of the people working within the Israeli government really want peace. I mean, there's a lot of emphasis given to talking about peace and a desire for peace, and yet the actions and the strategies that are employed, the tactics that are employed, don't point to that being the goal at all. And that's been really hard for me because I like to believe that that people's motivations, at least, are authentic. And I do question that now after what I've seen happen during the course of the past 7 years.
Right.
But as far as the individuals involved, as far as some of the amazing and wonderful people that we know in Israel, in the West Bank, in Gaza, and throughout the world, no, I have a lot of faith in what we together can do.
There has been some recent positive news from Rachel's alma mater. Evergreen State College students voted to divest from the illegal occupation of Palestine. Of course, that's the BDS movement, the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanction. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about that?
Yes, we're very excited. These were student initiatives on a student ballot. They also voted to make their campus a caterpillar-free campus.
Right.
They had a campaign of a couple of weeks and then some longer time preparing, but a campaign that lasted during that period. And each of those resolutions passed by over 70% of the student body supporting them. The next step will be, and we'll hear about their next step. This is all students. Directed, but as I understand it, they will be certainly presenting those to the administration and to the Evergreen State College Foundation, where a lot of funds for scholarship and so forth are invested. And I think we'll be making a strong case for why the college will need to look at those investments and possibly make some changes.
Right. And of course, all this can be accessed from your website, rachelcoreyfoundation.org, and spelt RACHELCORRIE foundation.org. That's the main website. And of course, there's another website called rachelswords.com. And there's one more called Critical Concerns. Is that right?
There is a critical concern website that has a page about Rachel. It's really a collection of a lot of the news articles and all the different responses to Rachel's killing, particularly in the earliest years. So if people are looking for those kinds of resources, they can go there.
Right. But the main website, of course, is rachelcoreyfoundation.org, where you have several tabs: home, about, Rachel Corey, projects, PeaceWorks, blogs, and the trial updates, which, of course, all that information can be garnered there. And of course, the emails, which are really powerful emails, and many parts of them are chilling. And I'm looking at her last email to you, Craig, and in the last paragraph where she says, she starts it off with, let me know if you have any ideas about what I should do with the rest of my life. I think that, yeah.
Isn't that one of the blessings out of all this? And it took me a couple of years to really figure it out because, for instance, you mentioned the play My Name is Rachel Corey, and there's a correspondence between Rachel and me. And everything that we have of Rachel now is what was written. So, and she and I didn't write to each other very often. She wrote to her mother, and I almost never wrote. Doesn't mean we weren't talking.
Sure.
But anyway, what I was thinking is that the last thing, our last communication to her, and my writing, just happened to be both telling her I loved her and how much I respected her. And then she actually responded to that, I think on a Wednesday, and she was killed the next Sunday. So that's the last we had out of her. So partly that's in the play. So, and I've seen the play a lot of times. So
right.
Just by bonehead luck in some ways, it manages to be the sort of thing you'd actually want to tell somebody like that. You know, if you had
right.
if you could choose last words. Then I wasn't wise enough to do that, but I was lucky enough that that was part of it. But also, she responds with this wonderful thing about what, you know, don't worry about me, I'm not in much danger, and it's so optimistic, what can I do with the rest of my life, and asking for fatherly advice. Not that she would have taken my advice
right.
about what to do with the rest of her life, but, you know, thank you for asking, dear. And yeah, just what a amazing, wonderful serendipity that was our last communication, and not yelling about whether you could have the car or any of those things you go through with a teenager.
Right, of course.
You know, that are also just part of being human, you know, and I treasure so much now, you know, the complexity of a human being. You know, you also alluded, and we haven't really mentioned it here, there is a book out of Rachel's writing, and actually it was Alan Rickman who put the play together, was one of the first people to comment on how different her early writing was, that her voice just changed when she got to Palestine and became more of a reporter, and she's more angry. You can see some of the whimsy in some of the stuff she writes there, but Rachel's words, it's yeah, that's email and stuff back from Gaza. And her earlier writing is interesting, and that's all put together in the book, Let Me Stand Alone. So that kind of follows her from when she was 10 years old. I remember when she was in fifth grade and 10 years old,
right.
Taking her to work and an adult asking her that question that all adults ask kids, you know, what do you want to be when you grow up? And she looked this friend of mine square in the eye, and she said, I am a poet.
Wow. This was when she was 10.
Yeah.
That's great.
And she was writing from an early age, and it's interesting for a father, I think, you know, some of that earlier stuff is a little easier to swallow than when she's in the midst amongst all that violence and you know, and so much threat. But it is interesting, and remember we did a small book tour when it came out, and this girl who described herself as a junior in high school and that she didn't know anything about the Middle East when she heard about Rachel's killing and started to learn about it after that. And when she said, when the book came out, I thought I would learn a lot about Gaza from it, and I've read about half the book. She said, I never expected to learn about my own high school. And so, you know, that was, wow. I thought, woman, can I get you to say something for the cover here?
Right. And, wow. Let Me Stand Alone, the Journals of Rachel Corey?
That's right.
You're right. By Norton.
Okay. And that was...
It's in paperback now, so it's been out for several years.
It was published by Norton. It is available through bookstores. People, if it's not in their bookstores, they can ask for it, which would be a wonderful thing, and because we'd like to see it on bookshelves everywhere.
Sure. Is it on your website, the foundation website?
I think it is, yes. I'm sure there should be discussion of it on the foundation website. And we always encourage people to, if they're going to order something, or to go to local bookstores, because that's what Rachel would have advocated. She was a big supporter of local bookstores.
And the reason I had mentioned that email, that the beginning of that last paragraph where she said, let me know if you have any ideas about what I should do with the rest of my life. Well, of course, she couldn't foresee what she's doing with the rest of her life, because she's very much alive and she's affecting millions and millions of people as you are. And I really want to thank you for the time you took out today.
Thank you.
Explaining everything to everybody the way that you did, and you're doing some great things, and I know I could safely say, I'm sure there's millions of people who are going to hear this and who would agree with me that you two are wonderful. You're doing some wonderful things, some great things, very brave, and I wish you all the best of luck and hope that things turn out for you the way that they should. And I would love to talk to you again in the future.
That would be wonderful. Thanks for a very good conversation.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you, Craig and Cindy.
Bye.